In Congo, it seems the land owns the people. How could I explain to Anatole about soybean fields where men sat in huge tractors like kings on thrones, taming the soil from one horizon to the other? It seemed like a memory trick or a blue-green dream. Impossible. At home, I said, we don't have the jungle. Then what is it you have? Big fields, like a manioc garden as wide and long as the Kwilu. There used to be trees, I guess, but people cut them down. And they did not grow back. Our trees aren't so vivacious as yours are. It's taken Father and me the longest time just to figure out how things grow here. Remember when we first came and cleared out a patch for our garden? Now you can't even see where it was. Everything grew like topsy and then died. The dirt turned into dead red slop like rotten meat. Then vines grew all over it. We thought we were going to teach people here how to have crops like we have back home. He laughed. Manioc fields as long and wide as the Kwilu. You don't believe me, but it's true. You can't picture it because here, I guess, if you cut down enough jungle to plant fields that big, the rain would just turn it into a river of mud. And then the drought would bake it. Yes, and if you ever did get any crops, the roads would be washed out so you'd never get your stuff into town anyway. He clucked his tongue. You must find the Congo a very uncooperative place. You just can't imagine how different it is from what we're used to. At home, we have cities and cars and things because nature is organized a whole different way. He listened with his head cocked to the side. And still, your father came here determined to plant his American garden in the Congo. My father thinks the Congo is just lagging behind and he can help bring it up to snuff, which is crazy. It's like he's trying to put rubber tires on a horse. Anatole raised his eyebrows. I don't suppose he's ever seen a horse. They can't live in the Congo because of tsetse flies. I tried to think of some other work animal for my parable, but the Congo has none, not even cows. The point I was trying to make was so true there was not even a good way to say it. On a goat, I said finally, wheels on a goat, or on a chicken or a wife. My father's idea of what will make things work better doesn't fit anything here. Aye, bien, that poor goat of your father's is a very unhappy animal. And his wife, I thought. But I couldn't help picturing a goat with big tires stuck in the mud, and it made me giggle. Then I felt stupid. I could never tell if Anatole respected me or just thought I was an amusing child. I oughtn't to laugh at my father, I said. No, he said, touching his lips and rolling his eyes upward. I shouldn't. It's a sin. Sin, sin. I felt drenched and sick of it. I used to pray to God to make me just like him, smart and righteous and adequate to his will, I confessed. Now I don't even know what to wish for. I wish I were more like everybody else. He leaned forward and looked into my eyes. His finger moved from his lips toward my face and hovered, waiting for a place to plant its blessing. Bien, if you were more like everybody else, you would not be so bien, bien. I wish you'd tell me what that means, bien, bien. Don't I have a right to know my own name? His hand dropped to the table. I will tell you someday. If I never learned my French conjugations from Anatole, at least I would try to learn patience. Can I ask you something else? He considered this request, his left hand still holding his place in his book. Yes. Why do you translate the sermons for my father? I know what you think of our mission here. Do you? Well, I think I do. You came to dinner that time and explained how Tata Ndu doesn't like so many people following Christian ways instead of the old ways. I guess you probably think that, too, that the old ways were better. You don't care for the way the Belgians did the elections, and I don't think you're even so sure about girls teaching school. Bien, the Belgians did not come to me and ask, Anatole Ngemba, how shall we make the election? They merely said, Kilanga, here are your votes. You may cast them in this calabash bowl or that calabash bowl or toss them all in the river. My job was to explain that choice. Well, but still, I don't think you're very keen on what my father aims to accomplish here. I don't entirely know what he aims to accomplish here, do you? Tell the stories of Jesus and God's love. Bring them all to the Lord. And if no one translated his sermons, how would he tell those stories? That's a good question. I guess he'd keep trying in French and Kikongo, but he gets those mixed up pretty bad. People probably never would get it straight what he was doing here exactly. I think you are right. They might like your father more if they couldn't understand him, or they might like him less. It's hard to say. But if they understand his words, they can make up their own minds. I looked long and hard at Anatole. You respect my father, then. What I respect is what I have seen. Nothing can stay the same when somebody new walks into your house bringing gifts. Let's say he has brought you a cooking pot. You already had a cooking pot you liked well enough, but maybe this new one is bigger. You'll be very pleased and gloat about it by giving the old one to your sister. Or maybe the new pot has a hole in the bottom. In that case, you will thank your visitor very much, and when he is gone, you'll put it in the yard for feeding fish scales to the chickens. So you're just being polite. You don't believe in Jesus Christ at all. He clicked his tongue. What I believe in is not so important. I am a teacher. Do I believe in the multiplication tables? Do I believe in la langue française with its extra letters hanging onto every word like lazy children? No matter. People need to know what they are choosing. I've watched many white men come into our house always bringing things we never saw before. Maybe scissors or medicine or a motor for a boat. Maybe books. Maybe a plan for digging up diamonds or growing rubber. Maybe stories about Jesus. Some of these things seem very handy, and some turn out to be not so handy. It is important to distinguish. And if you didn't translate the Bible stories, then people might sign up to be Christian for the wrong reasons. They'd figure our God gave us scissors and malaria pills, so he's the way to go. He smiled at me sideways. This word, biene biene, you want to know what it means, then?
Yes.
It means, as true as the truth can be. I felt a tingling blush in my cheeks, and the embarrassment made me blush more. I tried to think of something to say, but couldn't. My eyes returned to French sentences I found I couldn't translate. Anatole, I said finally, if you could have anything in the world, what would you want? Without hesitation, he said, to see a map of the whole world at once. Really? You never have? Not all of it at once. I can't work out whether it's a triangle, a circle, or a square. It's round, I said, astonished. How could he not know? He'd gone to plantation schools and served in the houses of men who had shelves full of books. He spoke better English than Rachel, yet he didn't know the true shape of the world. Not a circle, but like this, I said, cupping my hands, round like a ball. Really, you've never seen a globe? I heard about a globe, a map on a ball. I wasn't sure I understood it correctly because I couldn't see how it would fit on a ball. Have you seen one? Anatole, I have one. In America, lots of people have them. He laughed. For what? To help them decide where to drive the automobile? I'm not joking. They're in schoolrooms and everywhere. I've spent so much time staring at globes, I could probably make one. He gave me a doubting look. I could. I mean it. You bring me a nice, clean calabash, and I'll make you a globe of your own. I would like that very much, he said, speaking to me now as a grown-up friend, not a child. For the first time ever, I felt certain of it. You know what? I shouldn't be teaching math. I should teach geography. I could tell your boys about the oceans and cities and all the wonders of the world. He smiled sadly. Bene, they would not believe you. Rachel. The day after my birthday, Axelrod came over and we went for a walk. I more or less knew to expect him. His routine was to fly out to his mystery destination on Thursdays, come back Mondays, and come to our house on Tuesdays. So I'd put on my tulip-tailored poison green suit, which has now officially faded to poison drab and lost two of its buttons. For the first half of last year, I prayed for a full-length mirror, and the second half, I praised the Lord we didn't have one. Still, who cares if my suit wasn't perfect? It wasn't a date, just a make-believe date for appearances. I planned to walk with him around the village and not a speck farther. I swore to Mother I would not set foot into the forest with him or anywhere out of sight. She says she doesn't trust him as far as she could throw him, and believe you me, from the look in her eye, I think she could throw him pretty far. But he's polite, and he's cleaned up his style. Standing in the doorway waiting for me in his regulation sanforized wash-and-wear khakis and pilot sunglasses, why, he very nearly almost looked handsome, if you could ignore the telltale signs that he's a certified creep. So we strolled out into the unbearable heat of August 21st, 1960. Bugs buzzed so loud it hurt your ears, and tiny red birds perched on the ends of long grass stalks beside the road, all swaying this way and that. Outside our village, the elephant grass grows so tall it meets above the road to make a shady tunnel. Sometimes you can start thinking the Congo is almost pretty. Almost. And then, don't look now, but a 4-inch-long cockroach or something will scurry across the path in front of you. That is exactly what happened next, and Axelrod kind of jumped on it and smashed it. I couldn't bear to look. The sound was bad enough, honestly, a cross between crackle and squish. But I suppose it was a chivalrous gesture on his part. Well, I do have to say it's nice to be protected for a change, I said. Around my house, if a giant cockroach turns up, someone will either tame it for a pet or cook it for dinner. You have an unusual family. And how, I said. That's about the politest way you could put it. I've been meaning to ask, he said, what happened to your sister? Which one? As far as I can tell, they all three got dropped on their heads when they were babies. He laughed. The one that limps, he said. Ada. Oh, her. Hemiplegia. Half her brain got wrecked some way before she was born, so the other half had to take over, and it makes her do certain things backwards. I'm used to having to give the scientific explanation for Ada. I see, he said. Are you aware she spies on me? She spies on everybody. Don't take it personally. Staring at somebody without making a peep is her idea of a conversation. We strolled past Mama Mwanza's and a bunch of other houses where mostly old men were sitting on buckets without a single tooth in their heads. We were also graced by the presence of little children running around totally naked except for a string of beads around their bellies. I ask you, why bother? They all ran out to the road to see how close they could get to us before they had to scream and run away. That's the favorite game. The women were all down at the manioc fields because it was still the end of the morning. Axelrod took out a pack of Lucky Strikes from his shirt pocket and shook it sideways towards me. I laughed and started to remind him that I'm not old enough, but then realized, my gosh, I was 17 years old. I could smoke if I wanted to. Why ever not? Even some Baptists smoke on appropriate occasions. I took one. Thanks. You know, I turned 17 yesterday, I told him, resting the cigarette lightly on my lips and pausing in the shade of a palm tree so he could light it for me. Congratulations, he said, muffled through the cigarette he put in his own mouth. I'd have taken you for older. That made me tingle, but not half as much as what happened next. Right there, in the middle of the road, he took the cigarette out of my mouth and put it in his, then struck a match on his thumbnail and lit the two of them together, exactly like Humphrey Bogart. Then ever so gently he put the lit cigarette back in my lips. It seemed almost like we'd kissed. Chills ran down my back, but I couldn't tell for sure if it was thrill chills or the creeps. Sometimes it's very hard to know the difference. I tried out holding the filter tip between my two fingers like the girls in magazine ads. So far so good with smoking, I thought. Then I drew in a breath, puckered my lips, and puffed it out, and almost instantly I felt dizzy. I coughed a time or two and Axelrod laughed. I haven't smoked for a while, I said. You know, it's hard for us to get things now. I can get you all the American cigarettes you want. Just say the word. Well, I wouldn't actually say anything about it to my parents. They're not big smokers. But it dawned on me to wonder, how in the world would he get American cigarettes in a country where you can't even buy toilet paper? You know a lot of men in high places, don't you? He laughed. Princess, you don't know the half of it. I'm sure I don't, I said. A bunch of the younger men were up on top of the church schoolhouse, patching the roof with palm leaves. Father must have organized this barnstorming party, I thought. And then I panicked. Oh, Lordy, here I was right out in broad daylight, refreshing my taste with a Lucky Strike. But a quick glance around told me Father was nowhere to be seen, thank goodness. Just a bunch of men singing and blabbing in the Congo language and fixing a roof, that's all it was. Why fix the roof now? That was a good question. Last year, around the time of my birthday, it was pouring down rain every single afternoon come heck or high river. But this summer, not a drop yet. Just the bugs screeching in the crackly dry grass and the air getting heavier and heavier on these muggy waiting-for-it days. The mugginess just made everybody itch for something, I think. Just then, a large group of women passed us coming back from their manioc field. Huge bundles of giant brown roots tied together with rope were balanced on their heads. The women moved slowly and gracefully, putting one foot ahead of the other, and with their thin bodies all draped in colorful paniers and their heads held so straight and high, honestly, though it is strange to say, they looked like fashion models. Maybe it's just been too long since I've seen a fashion magazine. But some of them here, I guess, are very pretty in their way. Axelrod seemed to think so. He gave them a little salute to the tip of his hat, which he probably forgot he wasn't wearing. Mbote a akento akwa kilanga, benzika kooko. Every single one of them looked away from us toward the ground. It was very strange. What in the world did you say to them? I asked after they'd passed by. Hey there, ladies of Kalanga. Why don't you cut me some slack for a change? That's more or less what I said. Well, sir, they sure didn't, did they? He laughed. They just don't want any trouble with jealous husbands. This is what I mean about Axelrod. You can't for one minute let yourself forget he's a creep. Right there in front of me, his supposed fiancée flirting with the entire female contribution of Kalanga. And the bit about jealous husbands, I'm sure. As far as we could see, nobody in Kalanga liked Axelrod one iota, man or woman. Mother and father had commentated on this. The women seemed to despise him especially. Whenever he tried to make deals with them to fly their manioc and bananas to Stanleyville, I had personally seen them spit on his shoes. "No great loss, believe me," he said. "I prefer a Akento Aqua Elizabethville." "And what's so special about women from Elizabethville?" He tipped back his head, smiled, and blew smoke into the muggy sky. Today it really looked like it might rain at last, and felt like it, too. The air felt like somebody's hot breath all over your body, even under your clothes. "Experience," he said. Well, I knew I'd better change the train of this conversation. I took a nonchalant puff on my cigarette without breathing in very much. I still felt dizzy. "Where is Elizabethville, anyway?"
"Down south, Katanga Province. The new nation of Katanga, I should say. Did you know Katanga has seceded from the Congo?"
I sighed, feeling lightheaded. "I'm just happy to know somebody has succeeded in something. Is that where you go on your trips?"
"Sometimes," he said. "From now on, more than sometimes."
"Oh, really? You have new orders from the commando, I suppose."
"You have no idea," he said again. I was getting a little tired of hearing how I had no idea. Honestly, did he think I was a child?
"I'm sure I don't," I said.
We'd gotten to the edge of the village, past the chief's house, where we were supposed to make a point of Tata Ndu seeing us together, which we both forgot about. Now we were out where there were no more huts, and the tall elephant grass started to get tangled up with the edge of the jungle. I'd sworn I wouldn't go past the end of the village, but it's a woman's provocative to change your mind. Axelroot just kept walking, and suddenly I didn't care what happened next. I kept walking, too. Maybe it was the cigarettes. I felt very rash. I would get him to fly us out of here by hook or crook, was what I was thinking deep in my heart. It was cooler in the forest, anyway, and very quiet. When you listened, there were only bird sounds with silence in between, and those two sounds put together somehow seemed even quieter than no sound at all. It was very shadowy and nearly dark, even though it was the middle of the day. Axelroot stopped and put out his cigarette with his boot. He took mine from me, cupped my chin in his hand, and started to kiss me. Oh, Lordy, my first kiss, and I didn't even get a chance to get ready for it. I didn't, and I did, want him to do it. Mostly I did. He tasted like tobacco and salt, and the whole experience was very wet. Finally, I pushed him away. "That's enough of that," I said. "If we do anything, we should do it where people will see us, you know?" Well, well. He was smiling and ran the back of his hand along the side of my face. I'd expect more modesty from a preacher's daughter. "I'll show you, preacher's daughter. Go to hell, Axelroot." I turned around and started walking fast back toward the village. He caught up to me and put his arm on my shoulder to slow me back down to a stroll. "Mustn't let Tata Ndu see us having a lover's quarrel," he said, leaning down into my face. I tossed my head so my hair flew right in his nosy mug. We were still in the forest anyways, nowhere near Tata Ndu's house or anybody else's. "Come on," he coaxed. "Give me a smile. One pretty smile, and I'll tell you the biggest damn secret in Africa." "Oh, I'm sure," I said. But I was curious. I glanced at him. "So what's the secret? Does my family get to go home?" He laughed. "You still think you're the epicenter of a continent, don't you, princess?" "Don't be ridiculous," I said. I would have to ask Leah if an epicenter sent out good things or bad. If a man you're supposedly engaged to calls you one, you ought to know. He'd slowed me down till we were walking at an absolute snail's pace. It made me nervous. But he was going to tell me his secret if I just waited. I could tell he was itching to, so I didn't ask. I know a thing or two about men. Finally, here it came. "Somebody's going to die," he announced. "Well, big surprise," I said. "Somebody dies around here about every 10.5 seconds. But of course I wondered who. I felt a little scared, but still didn't ask. We kept walking step by step. I had to. He still had his arm around me. "Somebody that matters," he said. "Everybody matters," I informed him. "In the eyes of our Lord Jesus Christ, they do. Even the sparrows that fall out of their little nests and whatnot." He positively snorted at that. "Princess, you have much to learn. Alive, nobody matters much in the long run, but dead, some men matter more than others." I was sick of his guessing game. "All right then, who?" He put his mouth so close to my ear I could feel his lips on my hair. He whispered, "Lumumba." "Patrice Lumumba, the president?" I asked out loud, startled. "Or whatever he is, the one they elected?" "As good as dead," he said in a quiet, so-what voice that chilled my blood. "Do you mean to tell me he's sick or something?" "I mean his number is up. He's going to get it."
"And how would you happen to know that?"
"I would happen to know that," he said, mocking me, "because I'm in a position to know." "Take my word for it, sister. Yesterday, Big Shot sent a cable to Devil One with orders to replace the new Congolese government by force." I intercepted the news in code on my radio. My own orders will be coming before the end of the week, I guarantee you. Now that was so much bunk, I'm sure, because nobody in our village has a radio. But I let him go on talking in his little riddles if that was what buttered his toast. He said Devil One was supposed to get his so-called operatives to convince the army men to go against Lumumba. Supposedly, this Devil One person was going to get $1 million from the United States to pay soldiers to do that, go against the very person they all just elected. $1 million, when we couldn't even get 50 measly greenbacks a month for our bread and board. That was a likely story. I almost felt sorry for Axelroot, wanting so bad to impress me into kissing him again that he'd make up ridiculous stories. I may be a preacher's daughter, but I know a thing or two, and one of them is when men want to kiss you, they act like they're just on the brink of doing something that's going to change the whole wide world. Ada. Presentiment is that long shadow on the lawn, indicative that suns go down, the notice to the startled grass that darkness is about to pass. Pity the poor, dumb, startled grass. I do. Sisap ot tuoba. About to pass. I am fond of Miss Emily Dickinson. Or No Snickety Lime, a contrary name with a delicious sour green taste. Reading her secrets and polite small cruelties of her heart, I believe she enjoyed taking the dumb grass by surprise in her poem. Cumbered in her body, dressed in black, hunched over her secret notebook with window blinds shut against the happy, careless people outside, she makes small scratching sounds with her pen, covering with nightfall all creatures that really should know what to expect by now, but don't. She liked herself best in darkness, as do I. In darkness, when all cats are equally black, I move as gracefully as anyone. Benduka is the bent sideways girl who walks slowly. But Bendica is also the name of a fast-flying bird, the swallow with curved wings who darts crookedly quick through trees near the river. This bird I can follow. I am the smooth, elegant black cat who slips from the house as a liquid shadow after dark. Night is the time for seeing without being seen. With my own narrow shadow for a boat, I navigate the streams of moonlight that run between shadow islands and the date palm grove. Bats pierce the night with bell voices like knives. Bats stab, and owls call out to the Bikinda, spirits of the dead. The owls, only hungry like everyone else, looking for souls to eat. In the long perishing of children from Kakakaka, I saw the air change color. It was blue with Bilala, the wailing for the dead. It came inside our house where our mother stopped up her ears and her mouth. Bila Yebandu, Bila Yebandu. Why, they sang, the mothers who staggered down our road behind small, tightly wrapped corpses, mothers crazy walking on their knees with mouths open wide like a hole ripped in mosquito netting. That mouth hole, jagged, torn place in their spirits that lets the small, flying agonies pass in and out. Mothers with eyes squeezed shut, dark cheek muscles tied in knots, heads thrashing from side to side as they passed. All this we saw from our windows. Two times I saw more. The Reverend forbade us to observe any ritual over which he was not asked to preside, but twice, at night, I slipped out to spy on the funerals. Inside a grove of trees, the mothers threw themselves on mounds of dirt that covered their children. Crawled on their hands and knees, tried to eat the dirt from the graves. Other women had to pull them away. The owls croon and croon, and the air must be thick with the spirits of children dead. Months have passed since then, and the Reverend has spoken with every mother who lost children. Some are pregnant again. He reports to his family after a long day's work. These women don't wish to speak of the dead. They will not say their children's names. He has tried to explain how baptism, the batiza, would have changed everything. But the mothers tell him no, they had already tied the nkisi around the child's neck or wrist, a fetish from the Nganga Kuvudundu to ward off evil. They were good mothers and did not neglect this protection, they tell the Reverend. Someone else just had a stronger evil. Our father tries to make them understand the batisa is no fetish, but a contract with Jesus Christ. If baptized, the children would be in heaven now. And the mothers look at him, slant-eyed. If my daughter were in heaven, could she still watch the baby while I work in my manioc? Could she carry water for me? Would a son in heaven have wives to take care of me when I am old? Our father takes their ironical and self-interested tone to indicate a lack of genuine grief. His scientific conclusion, the Congolese do not become attached to their children as we Americans do. Oh, a man of the world is our father. He is writing a learned article on this subject for the Baptist scholars back home. Outside the house of Eben Axelrut, Torlexa Nebi, I peer through the window. Reap I, eeps ama I am a spy. I peer. In darkness, one small dark left eye at the glass. Banana leaves cover the dirty glass like papery window blinds, leaving long narrow triangles for my eye. Torlexa Nebi caught me near his latrine one afternoon, loitering, he said, as if that stinking place were a coveted shelter and myself a supplicant to his excrement. And now, he believes, he has frightened me off for good and evil. Now I go only at night when all is plainer, plain-lit shapes inside, his face and radio ringed with bright devil halos and kerosene lantern light. The radio, a live mass of wire oozing from his trunk, a seething congregation of snakes. He speaks through the snakes, and he speaks unutterable things, names in code. Some I understand. Ugor I.W. W.I. Rogue. A form of name that belongs to some form of man. Between two leaves, I finally saw W.I. Rogue. He came in the airplane at dusk and stayed until morning, hidden in the house of Torlexa. The two men drank whiskey from bottles and filled the room with a stratified lake of cigarette smoke in the flame-white light of night. They pronounced a litany of names to the mass of snakes. Other names they spoke aloud to each other. Always, they say, as good as dead, Patrice Lumumba. The voice on the radio said it many times. But the name the two men spoke out loud to each other was the President. Not Lumumba, President. Eisenhower. We like Ike. Ike, Ekil, you. The King of America wants a tall, thin man in the Congo to be dead. Too many pebbles cast for the bottle. The bottle must be broken. My knees plunged. A rush of hot blood made me fall. A faintness of the body is my familiar, but not the sudden evil faint of a body infected by horrible surprise. By this secret, the smiling, bald man with the grandfather face has another face. It can speak through snakes and order that a president far away, after all those pebbles were carried upriver in precious canoes that did not tip over, this President Lumumba shall be killed. I crept to my bed and wrote what I had seen and heard, then wrote the ending backwards. Stared at the words in my notebook, my captive poem. Redrum sekil o weki ekil you. We like Ike, who likes murder. By morning, it had lost the power to shock. Really, in daylight, where is the surprise of this? How is it different from Grandfather God sending the African children to hell for being born too far from a Baptist church? I should like to stand up in Sunday school now and ask, may Africa talk back? Might those pagan babies send us to hell for living too far from a jungle? Because we have not tasted the sacrament of palm nuts? Or, might the tall, thin man rise up and declare, we don't like Ike? So sorry, but Ike should perhaps be killed now with a poisoned arrow. Oh, the magazines would have something to say about that, all right. What sort of man would wish to murder the president of another land? None but a barbarian, a man with a bone in his hair. I want to see no more, but go back anyway. Called back, one-track, jet-black Ada. Damn mad Ada. Ada who swears to wear black and scratch out dreadful poems. Ha! I want to make the shadow pass over all the clean, startled faces, all those who believe in President Grandfathers, starting with Leah. Called back among the banana leaves that do not speak in the silent night, I listen. Joe from Paris coming, the radio says. Joe from Paris has made a poison that will seem to be a Congolese disease, a mere African death for Lumumba. W.I. Rogue says they will put it in his toothpaste. Torlexa laughs and laughs, for here they do not use toothbrushes. They chew the mutiete grass to clean their teeth. Torlexa grows angry then. He has lived here 10 years and knows more, he says. He should be running the show, he says, and I wonder what is the show. Through triangles between quiet banana leaves, I saw flame-haloed faces laugh at the promise of death everlasting. Presentiment, that long shadow passes over, and we are the startled grass. Leah. This awful night is the worst we've ever known, the Nsongunya. They came on us like a nightmare. Nelson, bang, bang, banging on the back door, got tangled up with my sleep so that even after I was awake, the next hours had the unsteady presence of a dream. Before I even knew where I was, I found myself pulled along by somebody's hand in the dark and a horrible fiery sting sloshing up my calves. We were wading through very hot water, I thought, but it couldn't be water, so I tried to ask the name of the burning liquid that had flooded our house. No, for we were already outside, that had flooded the whole world. "Nsongonya," they kept shouting. "Le formi, un corps d'armée." Ants. We were walking on, surrounded, enclosed, enveloped, being eaten by ants. Every surface was covered and boiling, and the path like black flowing lava in the moonlight. Dark bulbous tree trunks seethed and bulged. The grass had become a field of dark daggers standing upright, churning and crumpling in on themselves. We walked on ants and ran on them, releasing their vinegary smell to the weird, quiet night. Hardly anyone spoke. We just ran as fast as we could alongside our neighbors. Adults carried babies and goats, children carried pots of food and dogs and younger brothers and sisters, the whole village of Kalunga. I thought of Mama Mwanza. Would her sluggish sons carry her? Crowded together, we moved down the road like a rushing stream, ran till we reached the river, and there we stopped. All of us shifting from foot to foot, slapping, some people moaning in pain, but only the babies shrieking and wailing out loud. Strong men sloshed in slow motion through waist-deep water, dragging their boats, while the rest of us waited our turn to get in someone's canoe. "Be'ene, where is your family?" I jumped. The person beside me was Anatole. "I don't know. I don't really know where anybody is. I just ran." I was still waking up, and it struck me now with force that I should have been looking out for my family. I'd thought to worry about Mama Mwanza, but not my own crippled twin. A moan rose out of me. "Oh, God. What is it?" "I don't know where they are. Oh, dear God, Ada will get eaten alive. Ada and Ruth May." His hand touched mine in the dark. "I'll find them. Stay here until I come back for you." He spoke softly to someone next to me, then disappeared. It seemed impossible to stand still where the ground was black with ants, but there was nowhere else to go. How could I leave Ada behind again? Once in the womb, once to the lion, and now, like Simon Peter, I had denied her for the third time. I looked for her, or mother, or anyone, but only saw other mothers running into the water with small, sobbing children, trying to splash and rub their arms and legs and faces clean of ants. A few old people had waded out neck-deep. Far out in the river I could see the half-white, half-black head of balding old Mama Lalaba, who must have decided crocodiles were preferable to death by Nsongonya. The rest of us waded in the shallows where the water's slick shine was veiled with a dark lace of floating ants. "Father, forgive me according to the multitude of thy mercies. I have done everything so wrong, and now there will be no escape for any of us." An enormous moon trembled on the dark face of the Kwilu River. I stared hard at the ballooning pink reflection, believing this might be the last thing I would look upon before my eyes were chewed out of my skull. Though I didn't deserve it, I wanted to rise to heaven remembering something of beauty from the Congo. Rachel. I thought I had died and gone to hell, but it's worse than that. I'm alive in hell. While everybody was running from the house, I cast around in a frenzy, trying to think what to save. It was so dark I could hardly see, but I had a very clear presence of mind. I only had time to save one precious thing, something from home. Not my clothes, there wasn't time, and not the Bible. It didn't seem worth saving at that moment, so help me God. It had to be my mirror. Mother was screaming us out the door with the very force of her lungs, but I turned around and shoved straight past her and went back, knowing what I had to do. I grabbed my mirror, simply broke the frame Nelson had made for it, and tore it right down from the wall. Then I ran as fast as my legs would carry me. Out in the road, it was a melee of shoving, strangers touching and shoving at me. The night of 10,000 smells. The bugs were all over me, eating my skin, starting at my ankles and crawling up under my pajamas till they would end up God knows where. Father was somewhere nearby because I could hear him yelling about Moses and the Egyptians and the river running with blood and whatnot. I clasped my mirror to my chest so it wouldn't get lost or broken. We were running for the river. At first I didn't know why or where, but it didn't matter. You couldn't go anywhere else because the crowd just forced you along. It caused me to recall something I'd read once. If you're ever in a crowded theater and there's a fire, you should stick out your elbows and raise up your feet. How to Survive 101 Calamities was the name of the book, which covered what to do in any dire situation. Falling elevators, train wrecks, theater fires, etc. And thank goodness I'd read it, because now I was in a jam and knew just what to do. I stuck my elbows very hard into the ribs of the people who were crushing in around me and kind of wedged myself in. Then I just more or less picked up my feet and it worked like a charm. Instead of getting trampled, I simply floated like a stick in a river, carried along on everybody else's power. But as soon as we reached the river, my world came crashing down. The rush came to a standstill, yet the ants were still swarming everywhere. The minute I stood up on the riverbank, I got covered with them again, positively crawling. I couldn't bear it another second and wished I would die. They were in my hair. Never in my innocent childhood did I prepare for being in the Congo one dark night with ants tearing at my scalp. I might as well be cooked in a cannibal pot. My life has come to this. It took me a moment to realize people were climbing into boats and escaping. I screamed to be put in a boat, but they all ignored me, no matter how hard I screamed. Father was over yonder trying to get people to pray for salvation, and no one listening to him either. Then I spotted Mama Wanza being carried on her husband's back toward the boats. They went right past me. She did deserve help, poor thing, but I personally have a delicate constitution. I waded out after her and tried to get into their family's boat. All the Mwanza children were still clamoring in, and since I'm their neighbor, I thought surely they would want me with them, but I was suddenly thrown back by someone's arm across my face. Slam bang, thank you very much. I was thrown right into the mud. Before I even realized what had happened, my precious mirror had slipped from my hand and cracked against the side of the boat. I scooped it up quickly from the river's edge, but as I stood up, the pieces slid apart and fell like knives into the mud. I stood watching in shock as the boat sloshed away from the shore. They left me, and my mirror strewn all around, reflecting moonlight in crazy shapes. Just left me flat in the middle of all that bad luck and broken sky. Ruth May. Everybody was whooping and hollowing, and I kicked my legs to get down, but I couldn't because Mama had a hold of me so tight it was hurting my arm. Hush, little baby, hush. She was running along, so it kind of bounced when she said it. She used to sing me, hush, little baby, Mama's going to buy you a looking glass. She was going to buy me every single thing, even if it got all broke or turned out wrong. When we got down there where everybody was, she put me over her shoulder and stepped in the boat sideways with somebody's hands holding me up, and the boat was wobbly. We sat down. She made me get down. It hurt. The little ants were biting us all over bad, and it burned. That time Leah fed one to the ant lion. Jesus saw that. Now his friends are all coming back to eat us up. Then we saw Ada. Mama reached out to her and started to cry and talk loud, like crying talking. And then somebody else had hold of me. It was somebody Congolese and not even Mama anymore, so I cried too. Who'll buy me a looking glass that gets broken, a mockingbird that won't sing? I kicked and kicked, but he wouldn't put me down. I heard babies crying and women crying, and I couldn't turn my head around to see. I was going away from Mama's, all I knew. Nelson says to think of a good place to go, so when it comes time to die, I won't. I'll disappear and go to that place. He said think of that place every day and night so my spirit will know the way. But I hadn't been. I knew where was safe, but after I got better, I forgot to think about it anymore. But when Mama ran down the road with me, I saw everybody was going to die. The whole world a-crying and a-yelling bad. So much noise. I put my fingers in my ears and tried to think of the safest place. I know what it is. It's a green mamba snake away up in the tree. You don't have to be afraid of them anymore because you are one. They lie so still on the tree branch, they're the same everything as the tree. You could be right next to one and not even know. It's so quiet there. That's just exactly what I want to go and be when I have to disappear. Your eyes will be little and round, but you are so far up there you can look down and see the whole world, Mama and everybody. The tribes of Ham, Shem, and Japheth all together. Finally, you are the highest one of all. Ada. Live was I, ere I saw evil. Now I am on the other side of that night and can tell the story, so perhaps I am still alive, though I feel no sign of it. And perhaps it was not evil I saw, but merely the way of all hearts when fear has stripped off the husk of kind pretensions. Is it evil to look at your child, then heft something else in your arms, and turn away? Nod, nab, abandon. Mother, I can read you backward and forward. Live was I ere I saw evil. I should have been devoured in my bed for all I seemed to be worth. In one moment alive, and in the next, left behind. Tugged from our beds by something or someone, the ruckus banging and shouting outside, my sisters leaped up screaming and were gone. I could not make a sound for the ants at my throat. I dragged myself out to moonlight and found a nightmare vision of dark red, boiling ground. Nothing stood still, no man or beast, not even the grass that writhed beneath the shadow dark and ravenous, not even the startled grass. Only my mother stood still. There she was, planted before me in the path, rising on thin legs out of the rootless, devouring earth. In her arms, crosswise like a load of kindling, Ruth May. I spoke out loud the only time. Help me. Your father, she said. I think he must have gone on ahead with Rachel. I wish he'd waited, honey. He'd carry you, but Rachel was... I don't know how she'll get through this. Leah will. Leah can take care of herself. She can. You can't. You can't. I spoke again. Please. She studied me for a moment, weighing my life, then nodded, shifted the load in her arms, turned away. Come on, she commanded over her shoulder. I tried to stay close behind her, but even under the weight of Ruth May, she was sinuous and quick in the crowd. My heels were nipped from behind by other feet. Stepped on, though I felt it vaguely, already numb from the burning ants. I knew when I went down. Someone's bare foot was on my calf and then my back, and I was being trampled, a crush of feet on my chest. I rolled over again and again, covering my head with my arms. I found my way to my elbows and raised myself up, grabbing with my strong left hand at legs that dragged me forward. Ants on my earlobes, my tongue, my eyelids. I heard myself crying out loud, such a strange noise, as if it came from my hair and fingernails, and again I came up. Once I looked for my mother and saw her far ahead. I followed, bent on my own rhythm, curved into the permanent song of my body, left behind. I did not know who it was that lifted me over the crowd and set me down into the canoe with my mother. I had to turn quickly to see him as he retreated. It was Anatole. We crossed the river together, mother and daughter, facing each other, low in the boat's quiet center. She tried to hold my hands, but could not. For the breadth of a river, we stared without speaking. That night I still could wonder why she did not help me. Live was I, ere I saw evil. Now I do not wonder at all. That night marks my life's dark center, the moment when growing up ended and the long downward slope toward death began. The wonder to me now is that I thought myself worth saving. But I did. I did. Oh-ho, did I. I reached out and clung for life with my good left hand like a claw, grasping at moving legs to raise myself from the dirt, desperate to save myself in a river of people saving themselves. And if they chanced to look down and see me struggling underneath them, they saw that even the crooked girl believed her own life was precious. That is what it means to be a beast in the kingdom. Leah. Suddenly, then, I was pushed from behind and pulled by other hands into a boat, and we were on the water, crossing to safety. Anatole clambered in behind me. I was stunned to see he had Ruth May over his shoulder like a fresh-killed antelope. Is she okay? She's sleeping, I think. 20 seconds ago, she was screaming. Your mother and Ada have gone ahead with Tatabawanda, he said. Praise God. Ada's all right? Ada is safe. Rachel is a demon. And your father is giving a sermon about Pharaoh's army and the plagues. Everyone is all right. I squatted low with my chin on my knees and watched my bare feet change slowly from dark auburn to speckled to white as the ants dispersed and forayed out into the bottom of the canoe. I could hardly feel the pain now. The feet I gazed at seemed to be someone else's. I gripped both sides of the boat, suddenly fearing I might vomit or pass out. When I could hold my head up again, I asked Anatole quietly, "Do you think this is the hand of God?" He didn't answer. Ruth May whimpered in her sleep. I waited so long for his answer, I finally decided he hadn't heard me, and then he simply said, "No." "Then why?" The world can always give you reasons. No rain, not enough for the ants to eat, something like that. Nsongonya are always moving anyway. It is their nature, whether God cares or not. He sounded bitter against God, bitter with reason. The night felt like a dream rushing past me too fast, like a stream in flood. And in this uncontrollable dream, Anatole was the one person who cared enough to help me. God didn't. I tried to see through the thick darkness that clung to the river, searching out the opposite shore. God hates us, I said. Don't blame God for what ants have to do. We all get hungry. Congolese people are not so different from Congolese ants. They have to swarm over a village and eat other people alive. When they are pushed down long enough, they will rise up. If they bite you, they are trying to fix things in the only way they know. The boat was crammed with people, but in the dark I couldn't recognize their hunched backs. Anatole and I were speaking English, and it seemed no one else was there. What does that mean, that you think it's all right to hurt people? You know me as a man. I don't have to tell you what I am. What I knew was that Anatole had helped us in more ways than my family could even keep track of. My sister was now sleeping on his shoulder. But you believe in what they're doing to the whites, even if you won't do it yourself. You're saying you're a revolutionary like the Jomu Pro. The dark, strong arms of a stranger paddled us forward while I shuddered with cold dread. It occurred to me that I feared Anatole's anger more than anything. "Things are not so simple as you think," he finally said, sounding neither angry nor especially kind. "This is not a time to explain the history of Congolese revolutionary movements." "Ada says President Eisenhower has sent orders to kill Lumumba," I confessed suddenly. After holding in this rank mouthful of words for many days, I spilled them out into our ant-infested boat. She heard it on Axel Root's radio. She says he's a mercenary killer working for the Americans. I waited for Anatole to make any response at all to this, but he didn't. A coldness like water swelled inside my stomach. It couldn't possibly be true, yet Ada has always had the power to know things I don't. She showed me the conversation between Axel Root and another man written down in her journal. Since then, I've had no clear view of safety. Where is the easy land of ice cream cones and new kid sneakers and We Like Ike, the country where I thought I knew the rules? Where is the place I can go home to? Is it true, Anatole? The water moved under us and away, a cold, rhythmic rush. I told you, this is not a time to talk.
I don't care. We're all going to die anyway, so I'll talk if I please.
If he was even still listening, he must have considered me a tedious child. But I had so much fright in me, I couldn't stop it from coming out. I longed for him to shush me, just tell me to be still, and that I was good. I want to be righteous, Anatole, to know right from wrong, that's all. I want to live the right way and be redeemed. I was trembling so hard I feared my bones might break. No word. I shouted to make him hear, "Don't you believe me? When I walk through the valley of the shadow, the Lord is supposed to be with me, and he's not. Do you see him here in this boat?" The man or large woman whose back I'd been leaning against shifted slightly, then settled lower. I vowed not to speak another word. But Anatole said suddenly, "Don't expect God's protection in places beyond God's dominion. It will only make you feel punished. I'm warning you, when things go badly, you will blame yourself."
"What are you telling me?"
"I am telling you what I am telling you. Don't try to make life a mathematics problem with yourself in the center and everything coming out equal. When you are good, bad things can still happen. And if you are bad, you can still be lucky." I could see what he thought, that my faith in justice was childish, no more useful here than tires on a horse. I felt the breath of God grow cold on my skin. "We should never have come here," I said. "We're just fools that have gotten by so far on dumb luck. That's what you think, isn't it?" "I will not answer that."
"Then you mean no, we shouldn't have come?"
"No, you shouldn't. But you are here, so yes, you should be here. There are more words in the world than no and yes."
"You're the only one here who'll even talk to us, Anatole. Nobody else cares about us, Anatole."
"Tata Bwanda is carrying your mother and sister in his boat. Tata Lekulu is rowing his boat with leaves stuffed in his ears while your father lectures him on loving the Lord. Nevertheless, Tata Lekulu is carrying him to safety. Did you know Mama Mwanza sometimes puts eggs from her own chickens under your hens when you aren't looking? How can you say no one cares about you?"
"Mama Mwanza does that? How do you know?"
He didn't say. I was stupid not to have figured it out. Nelson sometimes found oranges and manioc and even meat in our kitchen house when nothing was there the night before. I suppose we believed so hard in God's providence that we just accepted miracles in our favor. "You shouldn't have come here, Biene, but you are here, and nobody in Kalanga wants you to starve. They understand that white people make very troublesome ghosts." I pictured myself a ghost, bones and teeth. Rachel, a ghost with long white hair. Ada, a silent, staring ghost. Ruth May, a tree-climbing ghost, the squeeze of a small hand on your arm. My father was not a ghost. He was God with his back turned, hands clasped behind him and fierce eyes on the clouds. God had turned his back and was walking away. Quietly, I began to cry, and everything inside me came out through my eyes. "Anatole, Anatole," I whispered. "I'm scared to death of what's happening, and nobody here will talk to me. You're the only one." I repeated his name because it took the place of prayer.
Anatole's name anchored me to the earth, the water, the skin that held me in like a jar of water. I was a ghost in a jar. I love you, Anatole.
Leah, don't ever say that again.
I never will. We arrived at the opposite shore. Someone's rescued hen fluttered up to the bow of our boat and strutted placidly along the gunwale, its delicate waddle shaking as it plucked up ants. For the first time that night, I thought of our poor chickens shut up for the night in their coop. I pictured their bones laid clean and white in a pile on top of the eggs. 2 days later, when the rebel army of tiny soldiers had passed through Kalanga and we could go home again, that is exactly how we found our hens. I was surprised that their dislocated skeletons looked just the way I'd imagined them. This is what I must have learned the night God turned his back on me. How to foretell the future in chicken bones. Book 4. Bel and the Serpent. Do you not think that Bel is a living God? Do you not see how much he eats and drinks every day? Bel and the Serpent, 1:6. Orleana Price, Sanderling Island, Georgia. The sting of a fly, the Congolese say, can launch the end of the world. How simply things begin. Maybe it was just a chance meeting, a Belgian and an American, let's say, two old friends with a hunger in common, a hand in the diamond business. A fly buzzes and lights. They swat it away and step into the Belgian's meticulously polished office in Elizabethville. They're careful to ask after each other's families and profits, and to speak of how they are living in a time of great change, great opportunity. A map of the Congo lies on the mahogany table between them. When they talk of labor and foreign currency, their hunger moves apart from the gentlemanly conversation with a will of its own, licking at the edges of the map on the table, dividing it between them. They take turns leaning forward to point out their moves with shrewd congeniality, playing it like a chess match, the kind of game that allows civilized men to play at make-believe murder. Between moves, they tip their heads back, swirl blood-colored brandy in glass globes, and watch it crawl down the curved glass in liquid veins. Languidly, they bring their map to order. Who will be the kings, the rooks, and bishops rising up to strike at a distance? Which sacrificial pawns will be swept aside? African names roll apart like the heads of dried flowers crushed idly between thumb and forefinger. Ngoma, Mukenge, Mulele, Kasavubu, Lumumba. They crumble to dust on the carpet. Behind the gentlemen's barbered heads, dark mahogany planks stand at attention. The paneling of this office once breathed the humid air of a Congolese forest, gave shelter to life, felt the scales of snake belly on its branches. Now the planks hold their breath, with their backs to the wall. So do the mounted heads of rhinoceros and cheetah, evidence of the Belgian skill as a sport hunter. Cut down, they are now mute spies in the house built by foreigners. Outside the window, palm fronds rattle in a rising wind. An automobile creeps past. Leaves of unraveling newspaper blow into the rank water that runs in an open ditch. The newspaper wheels along the street, scattering its sheets onto the water where they float as translucent squares of lace. No one can say whether it's good news or bad. A woman strides alongside the ditch under her basket of roasted corn. When the Belgian rises to close the window, the scent of all this reaches him, the storm, the ditch, the woman with the corn. He shuts the window and returns to the world of his own making. The curtains are damask, the carpet is Turkish, the clock on the table is German, old but still accurate. The heads on the wall observe with eyes of imported glass. The perfect timepiece ticks, and in that small space between seconds, the fancy has turned to fact. Given time, legions of men are drawn into the game, both ebony and ivory. The Congo's CIA station chief, the National Security Council, even the President of the United States. And a young Congolese man named Joseph Mobutu, who'd walked barefoot into a newspaper office to complain about the food he was getting in the army. A Belgian newspaperman there recognized wit and raw avarice, a useful combination in any game. He took this young Mobutu under his wing and taught him to navigate the airy heights where foreigners dwell. A rook who would be king. And the peace that will fall? Patrice Lumumba, a postal worker elected to head his nation. The Belgians and Americans agree. Lumumba is difficult, altogether too exciting to the Congolese, and disinclined to let white control the board, preferring the council and company of black. The players move swiftly and in secret. Each broad turn sweeps across rivers, forests, continents, and oceans, witnessed only by foreign glass eyes and once mighty native trees cut away from their roots. I've surmised this scene, assembled it piece by piece over many years from the things I read when it all began to come out. I try to imagine these men and their game, for it helps place my own regrettable acts on a broader field where they seem smaller. What trivial thing was I doing while they divided the map beneath my feet? Who was the woman walking by with the roasted corn? Might she have been some distant kin of someone I haggled with on market days? How is it that neither of us knew the ways of the world for so long? 15 years after independence, in 1975, a group of senators called the Church Committee took it upon themselves to look into the secret operations that had been brought to bear on the Congo. The world rocked with surprise. The Church Committee found notes from secret meetings of the National Security Council and President Eisenhower. In their locked room, these men had put their heads together and proclaimed Patrice Lumumba a danger to the safety of the world. The same Patrice Lumumba, mind you, who washed his face each morning from a dented tin bowl, relieved himself in a carefully chosen bush, and went out to seek the faces of his nation. Imagine if he could have heard those words, dangerous to the safety of the world, from a room full of white men who held in their manicured hands the disposition of armies and atomic bombs, the power to extinguish every life on earth. Would Lumumba have screamed like a cheetah, or merely taken off his glasses, wiped them with his handkerchief, shaken his head, and smiled? On a day late in August, 1960, a Mr. Alan Dulles, who was in charge of the CIA, sent a telegram to his Congolese station chief, suggesting that he replace the Congolese government at his earliest convenience. The station chief, Mr. Lawrence Devlin, was instructed to take as bold an action as he could keep secret. A coup would be all right. There would be money forthcoming to pay soldiers for that purpose. But assassination might be less costly. A gang of men quick with guns and unfettered by conscience were at his disposal. Also, to cover all bases, a scientist named Dr. Gottlieb was hired to make a poison that would produce such a dreadful disease, the good doctor later testified in the hearings. If it didn't kill Lumumba outright, it would leave him so disfigured that he couldn't possibly be a leader of men. On the same August day, this is all I knew. The pain in my household seemed plenty large enough to fill the whole world. Ruth May was slipping away into her fever, and it was Rachel's 17th birthday. I was wrapping up green glass earrings in tissue paper, hoping to make some small peace with my eldest child while I tried to sponge the fire out of my youngest. And President Eisenhower was right then sending his orders to take over the Congo. Imagine that. His household was the world, and he'd finished making up his mind about things. He'd given Lumumba a chance, he felt. The Congo had been independent for 51 days. Mr. Devlin and his friends sat down with the ambitious young Mobutu, who'd been promoted to colonel. On September 10th, they provided $1 million in UN money for the purpose of buying loyalty, and the State Department completed its plans for a coup that would put Mobutu in charge of the entire army. All the ducks were lined up. On September 14th, the army took control of the momentarily independent Republic of Congo, and Lumumba was put under house arrest in Leopoldville, surrounded by Mobutu's freshly purchased soldiers. Throughout those days, while we scratched and haggled for our daily bread, I had a photograph of President Eisenhower for company in my kitchen house. I'd cut it out of a magazine and nailed it over the plank counter where I kneaded the bread. It was so much a part of my life, I remember every detail of him. The clear-rimmed glasses and spotted tie, the broad smile, the grandfatherly bald head like a warm, bright light bulb. He looked so trustworthy and kind, a beacon from home reminding me of our purpose. On November 27th, very early in the day, probably while I was stoking our wood stove for breakfast, Lumumba escaped. He was secretly helped along by a net of supporters stretching wide across the Congo from Leopoldville to our own village and far beyond. Of course, no one spoke to me about it. We'd only heard faint rumors that Lumumba was in trouble. Frankly, we were more interested in the news that heavy rain was falling to the west of us and might soon reach our own parched village. The rain provided the Prime Minister's cover, as it turned out. Leopoldville had been drenched the previous night. I can imagine the silk texture of that cool air, the smell of Congolese earth curling its toes under a thatch of dead grass. In the dense fog, the nervous red glow of a guard cigarette as he sits dreaming, cursing the cold but probably rejoicing in the rain. Most likely he'd be the son of farmers. but in any case, alone now at the front gate of Lumumba's prison house in Leopoldville. The tires of a station wagon hiss to a stop in the darkness. The guard sits up, touches his uniform, sees the station wagon is full of women. A carload of household employees from the night shift on their way home to the shantytown margins of the city. The boy puts on an attitude of impatience. He's much too busy with matters of state to be bothered by maids and a chauffeur. He flicks his thumb and forefinger, motioning for the station wagon.